Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Mark, for that introduction. It's a pleasure for me to be here this morning. I'm very pleased to be able to continue the long-standing relationship between the Australian Industry Group and the Reserve Bank of Australia. Over the years, we've found this relationship very useful, and I hope and trust that this will continue. This morning, I would like to talk about some of recent developments in both the Australian and global economies, and then to briefly discuss some of the implications of those developments for the outlook for Australia. As I'm sure you are all aware, the global economy is now gradually recovering from what's been the worst downturn since at least World War II. But as you can see from this first chart here, the nature of this recovery is a two-track one. As a group, the G7 economies are experiencing only relatively weak growth, especially when viewed against the background of the very large contraction in output that occurred. In contrast, the picture in Asia is quite different, and many of the economies in the region have had near V-shaped recoveries. There's also been a fairly solid bounce back in some other parts of the world, with, for example, Brazil having grown very strongly over the past year. Now, this two-speed world is evident not just in the GDP data, as you can see in this chart, but also in the unemployment and the inflation data. As you can see from this graph, unemployment rates in both the United States and the euro area are around 10%, and a sustained reduction in these rates looks like it's some time off. In contrast, unemployment rates in Asia are now clearly falling, and they're much lower than in the major advanced economies. In terms of inflation, in both the US and the euro area, four measures of inflation are still trending down, as you can see from the top panel here, and they're likely to continue doing so for some time yet. Again, in contrast, core rates of inflation have clearly bottomed in Asia, and they now look to be rising in a number of countries in the region. But rather than go through more of these recent economic trends, I'd like to touch on three broad issues that are likely to play a major role in shaping how the world economy evolves over the next couple of years. And these three issues are: the first, the need for the advanced economies to consolidate their public finances, something that Barry talked about. Second is the realignment of capital flows around the world, given the likelihood of an extended period of low interest rates in the developed economies. And the third is the challenge of increasing domestic demand in Asia. Of these three issues, the one that's attracted the most attention recently is public finances. This is partly because of what's been going on in Greece, but more broadly it reflects the very difficult fiscal positions in which many of the advanced economies currently find themselves. In the US, the federal budget deficit for last year was around 10% of GDP. In Japan, the deficit was almost as large. The euro area was around 6%, and some of the euro area countries had significantly larger budget deficits than that average. And as you can see from this next chart, these large deficits come after three decades over which the ratio of public debt to GDP for the G7 economies as a whole trended higher. These large deficits also come at a time when there'll be significant medium-term budget pressures due to the aging of the population. So over coming years, many governments will need to take very significant steps to improve their public finances. And the flexibility that they have to determine the timing and the size of these steps is limited by the fact that they went into the current downturn with already high levels of debt. As a result of the poor starting point, many are now treading a very narrow path. On the one hand, tightening fiscal policy in the very near term risks derailing the recovery, while not doing so risks a damaging loss of confidence by the market. How these fiscal challenges are managed over the next few years is likely to have a major effect on how the world economy evolves. Presumably, what is required is for the affected countries to have credible medium-term fiscal consolidation strategies, While this is easier to say than to do, ensuring the confidence of investors is a critical ingredient if the recovery is to be sustained. Now, this brings me to my second issue, but it's clearly related, and that's capital flows. Most of the advanced economies are currently operating well below full capacity, and given the subdued nature of the recovery, it's likely that it will be some time before the excess capacity is wound back. Now, one consequence of this is that provided inflation expectations remain well anchored, official interest rates in these economies, which you can see from this graph, are already at historically low levels, are likely to remain below average for a considerable period of time. Now, in contrast, elsewhere, including Asia and in Australia, where growth is stronger, interest rates are likely to be relatively higher. And this interest differential is likely to lead to a flow of capital from the major advanced economies to Asia and to the other better performing areas of the world. Now, in Asia, concerns are already emerging about the implications of this. In particular, some countries are worried about the potential for volatile capital inflows to be destabilizing for their economies. The concern is that capital inflows in the near term will turn into capital outflows when interest rates in the advanced economies do eventually normalize, and that this process could be quite disruptive. And as a way of insuring themselves against the risk, some central banks in the region continue to accumulate large holdings of foreign reserves. A number of countries in the region are also concerned about the effects of capital flows on their domestic banking systems, with some already having taken steps to rein in bank lending growth, particularly where the property markets are strong. A related consideration here is the effect of these capital flows on exchange rates in the region. In general, there is considerably less tolerance for large movements in exchange rates in many of these countries than there is in Australia. In our own case, movements in the value of the Australian dollar are largely seen to be a stabilising force for the economy. There's also general acceptance of the view that over the next few years, our real exchange rate is likely to be higher than the average of the past decade or so. In contrast, in much of Asia, where international trade shares are higher than in Australia, movements in exchange rates tend to be viewed with much more concern, particularly if they're seen to be driven by speculative capital flows. One other related consideration is the impact on asset markets around the world of an extended period of low official interest rates in the major developed economies. When the global economy was in this situation around 5 years ago with very low interest rates, things did not work out well. While the current environment is clearly very different to that in the middle of the 2000s, this earlier experience suggests that we need to watch the financial side of the global economy very carefully, particularly when interest rates are low. The third issue I would like to touch on is the growth of domestic demand in Asia. For some decades, many countries in Asia have had a growth strategy focused on exports. And given the strong growth in consumption in the major Western economies, this strategy worked out well. However, many of the economies in Asia recognise that given the subdued outlook for the advanced economies, there will now need to be a stronger emphasis on growth in domestic demand than there had been in the past. And China provides a good example here. Over the past two decades, the share of household consumption in Chinese GDP has declined from just under 50% to around 35%, which is a very low level by international standards. You can see from this chart, this reflects two broad developments. The first is a reduction in the share of national income going to the household sector, as you can see in the left-hand side panel. And the second is an increase in the household saving rate in China, which you can see in the right-hand side panel. In China, as in many parts of Asia, there's now a recognition that policies to promote consumption are likely to play a major role, a more important role than was the case previously. In the past, strong consumption was often seen as something that would follow strong exports rather than a driver of the economy itself. see this view is gradually changing, and this is leading to an increased focus on structural reforms to increase the share of national income going to the household sector and to reduce the household saving rate. While reforms in these areas can be very difficult, they are important if Asia as a whole is to continue to grow strongly in the face of subdued demand for exports from the region. Now, how things play out in each of these areas, in public sector debt, in capital flows, and in structural policies in Asia, will have a significant impact on the global environment in which the Australian economy finds itself over the years ahead. At the Reserve Bank, we've spelled out a number of times recently our central scenario, and it's a relatively positive one. We expect the economies in Asia to continue to grow reasonably solidly, while the advanced economies, as Barry said, are expected to have only a subdued recovery, weighed down by the need to consolidate both the balance sheets in the private and in the public sector. But around this central scenario, there are clearly risks, and they're particularly associated with the three issues that I've just talked about. Now, given these risks, which are significant, one question is how should policy be set? The Reserve Bank's general approach here has been to proceed on the basis of the central scenario, but be prepared to respond if things turn out differently, as we did in late 2008 when the global outlook took a marked turn for the worse. The alternative of waiting to see how these myriad of risks evolve before adjusting policy runs the significant downside of moving too late, particularly given the economy starting the current upswing with less spare capacity than previous upswings. Unfortunately, in Australia, we've had the policy flexibility to respond to a changing event, and so far this has served us very well. I'd now like to turn more directly to recent developments in the Australian economy, where the run of data over the past few months has tended to be on the firm side. Employment growth has been robust. Business and consumer confidence is above average. The housing market's been strong. And there are signs that the period of business deleveraging is coming to an end. Collectively, these outcomes provide us with some confidence that the economy is now in a reasonably solid upswing. Over the course of this year, the nature of this upswing is likely to change somewhat. Recently, the overall level of spending in Australia has been supported by strong growth in public sector demand. You can see this in this chart here. And this has been at a time when private sector demand growth has been relatively weak. As we move into the second half of 2010, this configuration is likely to change somewhat. Public sector demand is expected to decline, particularly spending on the federal government school building program tails off. But moving in the other direction, private sector business investments expected to strengthen further, particularly in the resources sector. This expected rise in business investment is being underpinned by the strong outlook for the terms of trade. Recently, as you can see here, the spot prices for iron ore and coal have both risen substantially, and the prices that our exporters will receive over the next year look to be significantly higher than those received over the past year. As a result, we are forecasting a significant rise in the terms of trade. While movements in the terms of trade don't get the same high-frequency attention as many of the monthly economic indicators, history suggests that they can have a very significant influence on how the overall economy performs. Amongst other things, they affect the investment climate, the government's budget position, asset values, the level of confidence in the economy, and the growth in domestic incomes. So this improvement in the terms of trade is a significant factor affecting the outlook for the economy. In contrast to the terms of trade, one area that does get very high frequency attention is the property market. And over recent times, most indicators of conditions in the established housing market have been very buoyant. Auction clearance rates have been high. Nationwide measures of housing prices have been increasing by around 1% a month, and the prices in Melbourne have risen at an even faster rate. The rental market also remains quite tight, with rents having risen firmly and vacancy rates low. But notwithstanding these signs, there are a few contrary signs to this generally strong picture. As you can see in this next chart, total housing loan approvals declined in the months of October, November, December and January, and the declines were broader than those just the first home buyers following the scaling back of the additional grant. Some lenders have also tightened terms and conditions, including by further reducing maximum loan-to-value ratio. And in the lower-priced suburbs of most of the capital cities, housing prices have broadly moved sideways since October after they rose significantly earlier in the year. If we look forward, I think at the moment it's too early to tell whether these contrary signs indicate that some cooling in the property market's in prospect. It is, however, clearly desirable to avoid significant imbalances developing in the housing market, both in terms of the supply-demand situation and the price and financing dynamics. The pickup that we're seeing in dwelling construction at the moment will be helpful here, although further increases in dwelling construction is likely to be needed over the medium term. On the financing side, we are currently not seeing the type of financial development that caused concern in 2002 and 2003, when maximum LVRs were being raised, loan servicing requirements were being eased, new types of mortgage products were being introduced, and risk spreads were being compressed. Now, this is good news, as it obviously would be unhelpful if a speculative cycle were to emerge on the back of the recent strength in housing prices. I think this is an area that lenders and homeowners, including prospective homeowners, will need to watch carefully over the months ahead. The final topic I would like to touch on briefly is inflation. And here things have turned out pretty much as we had expected. In underlying terms, inflation has moderated significantly. The year-ended rate is expected to decline from its current rate of around 3.25% to around 2.5% over the course of 2010. This decline is being underpinned by a sharp slowing in wage growth in the private sector that we saw last year and by the appreciation of the currency. In addition, the Reserve Bank's liaison with retailers suggests there's been significant discounting recently and business surveys point to below average price increases. As we move forward, we need to ensure that inflation pressures remain contained and inflation expectations remain well anchored. Expansion of the supply side of the economy is obviously important here. So too is addressing potential bottlenecks and ensuring that our labour and our capital markets are sufficiently flexible so that resources are able to move where they're most productively used. In addition, the bank has noted a number of times recently that with the economy having relatively limited spare capacity, it is likely that interest rates will need to continue their gradual move towards more normal levels. So in summing up, our central scenario is for the world economy to grow at around an average pace over the next couple of years, with strong growth in a number of our major trading partners in Asia. Around this central scenario, there are significant risks as the flow-on effects of the events of the past 18 months continue to reverberate around the global economy. While we need to watch these flow-on effects very carefully, the outlook for Australia appears to be considerably brighter than that for most of the other advanced economies of the world. Thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer questions.
Doug Sutherland, Part 4. Philip, just interested in your definition of normal interest rates to combat the inflation going forward. Is that in that sort of 5 to 5.5% bracket?
Well, the important thing is that the level of interest rates that borrowers face, not the cash rate, and we all know that the differential there has widened. At the moment, the mortgage rate is still around 50 basis points below the average of the last decade and a half. So the mortgage rate is getting close to the average, but it's still below the average.
The bank has been pretty vocal in its statements that the government needs to promote the building of more housing. How? What sort of response are you getting from both the state and federal governments in that? At the moment, it seems only Victoria seems to be very positive in that situation.
Yeah, well, I don't think your characterisations are quite right here. We haven't been saying that government needs to do more things here. What we have been doing is pointing out that this is an issue that collectively our society needs to address, because the rate of population growth is very strong, fastest since the mid-1960s. Yet the rate at which we're adding to the number of dwellings is quite low, the lowest for quite a few decades. And from our perspective, that if that was to continue, then there'll be upward pressure on housing prices as a result of that. So in the medium term, we need to, if the population is to grow anything like the current rate, we need to devote more resources to housing, and we need to find the land to develop that extra housing. Exactly how that's done is clearly beyond our area of expertise, and we wouldn't presume to kind of tell the state government how to do that. What we are doing, though, is drawing this to people's attention and hoping to stimulate some public debate about how we increase the housing stock if the population is continuing to grow at around the current rates. But there are others, presumably in this room, who are better equipped than I am to say exactly how that should be done.
Dr. Lo, Kai Chow from the Sky News Business Channel. A couple of weeks ago at the Urban Development Conference, you said that business does seem to be turning the corner somewhat. Is that concentrated, though, in the bigger businesses? And are you concerned at all by a widening in the gap between big business and SMEs, like small businesses, and potential implications for the wider economy of a small business sector that seems to be lagging?
Well, I think we are seeing some of the same issues that Barry Hughes talked about in the US, with the large businesses feeling slightly more optimistic about the future than the small businesses, but the differences are not nearly as large as in the US. And I think one reason they're not as large is that small businesses here still do have access to credit. Conditions are tight, but unlike in the US, small businesses still do have access to credit. So there is a difference there. It's not nearly as marked as in the US. One other factor that's relevant is that the resource-based sector is doing particularly well, and that tends to be dominated by large businesses as well. So it's partly an industry story rather than a small versus large story. So I think the conditions are basically getting better for all businesses, big and large, and I think that's likely to continue.
In the light of the earlier question and your answer, in recent years, or just in recent months, has the margin that banks are putting on the cash rate become an important indicator for setting of the rate, more so than in the past?
Well, as we said a number of times, it's certainly something we take into account. Because ultimately what's important in the economy is the level of lending rates that borrowers face and the deposit rates that savers face. The cash rate is only applies to overnight unsecured lending between financial institutions. So it's an important interest rate, but it only affects a very limited set of financial activity in the economy. What is important is the lending rates that people, that businesses and households face. So we spend a lot of time, as you can tell through our public documents and our communication, thinking about the changes in the spreads, why they're occurring, and the impact on the economy. So it's certainly something that affects our setting of monetary policy, as I think it's entirely appropriate that it does.